Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. A permanent dinosaur gallery opens November 18 at Cosi Columbus, which has partnered with the American Museum of Natural History to develop the exhibit. It will be the largest permanent exhibit in Cosi history and the first time that the American Museum of Natural History has established such an outpost. Joining us is the division chair and curator for the Division of Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History, Mark Norell. Welcome.
Thank you.
Also, President and CEO of COSI, Frederick Bertley. Welcome back.
Thanks, Ann. Thanks for having us.
Frederick, what does an exhibit like this mean for COSI?
This is unbelievable, and it's really a transformational thing happening in the history of COSI. If you think COSI started in 1964 on Broad Street across the original Wendy's, moved in 1999 to its current location in Franklinton in the Scioto Peninsula, that was a transformative step.
Right.
What's happening November 18th and beyond is it's not just about bringing a fabulous dinosaur exhibit, which Dr. Norell will talk about in a minute. It's really the partnership with not just anyone, but the American Museum of Natural History.
You have an interesting way of describing it, something like the Celine Dion. I read the
You got to think about it. COSI is a top 10 science, legit science center in the country. And we're all around 330 to 400,000 square feet. Boston Museum of Science, California.
They're all clustered,
around 350, right? American Museum of Natural History is 1.7 million square feet. They are the LeBron James, Celine Dion, you name it, you know, of natural history and literally the best in the world. So for us, it's a fantastic opportunity to collaborate with the best and bring natural history to the Midwest.
So why Columbus?
I think you're going to have to ask Frederick that because I really wasn't.
You weren't involved in that part of it. So Frederick, why?
Yeah, and what I want to, for all transparency, while I'd like to claim to be the genius behind it, I'm inheriting this.
It was in the works.
It was in the works before I accepted. Yeah. But it's one of the reasons why I accepted the position. And why Columbus? Several reasons. One, Columbus is a bona fide strong city. Two, it has a amazing, I mean, you know this better than me. It's called the Columbus Way. Even Harvard talks about it. It's a collaborative and partnership city. And to pull something like this off, it's not just AM and H and COSI that had to get in bed together, but you had to have the CDC, the development group involved. You had to have the partnership involved. You have to have the private funders. You have to have the city. You had to have this collaborative spirit to pull off a partnership of this magnitude. And that's why Columbus stood up as attractive to the AM and H board and Ellen Futter.
Now, Mark, I know you're not one of the instigators of it necessarily, but can you talk about what's in it for the American Museum of Natural History?
Well, I think that there's several things. I mean, that we have a very, very active traveling exhibit program where we have, I think, around over a dozen exhibits that are out on the road traveling all over the world.
Which is very typical.
Yeah, and it's a way both to expand our brand, but it's also a way for us to be able to go out and show what we do as scientists at the American Museum and provide, you know, a service of telling scientific stories through objects and experiences that allows for a general education of, the general public places.
It's a permanent exhibit, but just given what I've read over the past 24 hours to prepare, it's going to have to change over time because what we know about dinosaurs is changing.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, some of the exhibits that I've worked on, that if I was to do them now, I'd have to change the entire thing.
Right.
But, you know, stuff does change. It changes really dramatically. And I think that this exhibit that, you know, shows that. I mean, some of the content in this exhibit was taken out of a project that I did called Ancient Fossils, New Discoveries, and how things have changed, how we're using new technologies to be able to study things that in some cases were collected over 100 years ago.
And that are thousands of years old.
Millions
of years old. It's amazing. How do dinosaurs fit into the broader mission of COSI?
Huge. And I want to pull back and say what we're opening November 18th is a permanent dinosaur gallery. But March 3rd, we'll be opening up a second gallery, all curated by, as Dr. Norell said, by content coming out of AM&H. So that will be right adjacent to our dinosaur. So we'll have about 23,000 square feet of amazing AM&H space, which is fantastic. What does dinosaurs mean to us? This is huge. I mean, as we talked on the last time I was on the show, you know, America, unfortunately, is backsliding with science literacy. We're becoming more and more science illiterate. And one of the cool things about dinosaurs is it transcends race, religion, age. Everybody likes dinosaurs. And so when you have such rich and, in our case, authentic content curated by AM&H in our building, people are going to be excited to come see dinosaurs because they love dinosaurs. But that's a way of us attracting them, getting them into the building, and then having those conversations around science, science literacy, and having that dialogue.
You know, just to be clear, the American Museum of Natural History is going to have the dinosaur exhibit, and you're saying there's going to be additional space there with other stuff?
Absolutely. So right now, November 18th, the world can come and see at COSI our brand new dinosaur gallery, which is curated by Mark Norell and content from AM&H. In March of 2018, we'll be opening an adjacent gallery that's also going to have content from AM&H that's part of the traveling series of exhibits that Dr. Norell mentioned.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the new dinosaur exhibit that starts opens November 18th at COSI Columbus. With me right now is president and CEO of COSI, Frederick Bertley, and also Mark Norell. He's the division chair and curator for the Division of Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History. Helped design the exhibit, curated, I guess is the way to put it. If you have a question or comment about dinosaurs, I can't think of a better day to give us a call. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. What can you just, Mark, give us a sense of the array that will be on display at COSI Columbus?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the exhibit really has two big aspects to it. You know, one is, as I mentioned before, of how we're using new technologies to be able to look at some of these old problems. I mean, everything from advanced engineering solutions to study how animals move, to advanced imaging situations where we're able to use CAT scans or, in some cases, synchrotron radiation to be able to discover things that never would have been possible a couple of decades ago.
Because to pull them apart would have been just too destructive.
Yeah, and all just different new kinds of studies, which we couldn't even think of, like how fast they grew and that kind of thing. Also, that it tells the story of something that my lab group's been very involved in over the last two decades, and that's that the origin of birds. You know, where did birds come from? And I think that people will be pretty shocked after they walk through the galleries and they see that what all the evidence, and when I say evidence, I mean very hard evidence, what some of these things that people thought originally were big scaly creatures actually looked like tyrannosaurs covered with feathers, for instance, and just how bird-like many of these animals were.
What are the – when I was reading about how the exhibit was going to be unfolded and brought out, there's the big, huge T-Rex, the resin bone skeleton of a T-Rex, which is one thing. It's like putting together a model airplane or something. But on the other hand, there are a lot of, you know, ancient, as you've said, millions of years old artifacts. How are they handled to move them for an exhibit like this?
They have to be handled pretty delicately, but, you know, the people move things like the Pietà and like big art shipping companies do these things. They build special cases for them. They're moved in, you know, trucks and stuff that have no vibration, and it's not that big a problem anymore to move them around.
I know art's an interest of yours.
Yeah.
And so it's an interesting way to compare it to great art. But it's little things and big things.
Yeah, it's things at all scale. I mean, some of the animals that we have on display in the exhibit are less than a foot long as full-size adults. You know, others are like the Tyrannosaur, which is 40 feet long.
Right, right. And that's why the exhibit has to be so big, for starters.
Yeah, I mean, we really wanted to have the complete story. And as Dr. Norell said, you're going to see the narrative of dinosaurs and the evolution of scientific thought and scientific understanding based on new discoveries. And so to tell the story really well, we wanted to have enough square footage to make sure we did the wonderful story justice.
How much space does the dinosaur exhibit take up?
It's about 12 to 13,000 square feet.
So for people who are really familiar with COSI Columbus, what can you compare it to?
Any one of our big traveling exhibits. So if you came to see Titanic back in the day, if you came to see May's Mindbenders, any one of our big traveling exhibits, this is bigger than all of those.
So. And they've been working on this since last January?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, it's taken a while to put together, but oh my gosh, it's so special. I can't wait to see people's faces when they enter the exhibit.
What about you, Mark? I mean, how does it compare to what's already at the American Museum of Natural History?
It's pretty different. You know, these shows originally, parts of them premiered at the American Museum of Natural History over the last 7 years or so.
Okay.
And whenever I design an exhibit or work on an exhibit or curate an exhibit at the museum, you know, I want to show people something different than we have in the permanent displays. So the permanent displays that we have is largely about the family tree of dinosaurs and how dinosaurs are related to one another and then telling different stories within that context. Whereas this show is a show largely about biology and engineering. So it just tells that how these animals lived, how do we know how they walked, how can we tell that they traveled in herds, how we know that some of these animals had feathers, how did they breathe, things like that. So it's a very, very biological story, and again, quite different than what we have on display permanently in New York.
What are you expecting this means for museum membership and attendance numbers?
Well, we're hoping it'll skyrocket. I just want to be transparent about that. And, yeah. And one of the reasons why is COSI is an incredible name brand. People always remember going there, or I took my children there, I went as a kid. When you partner with natural history, that really expands the age, what I talk about, from the womb to the tomb. I mean, natural history is for everybody of all ages. So we're looking forward to getting our members who are bona fide and loyal members to, of course, re-up their membership. We want to increase that membership pool. But we also want to increase people traveling in from an hour or 2 hours out to come in and see what, as Dr. Norell said, is not available anywhere else. I mean, they, meaning the AM&H, put together a phenomenal, one-of-a-kind exhibit based on a lot of different things they've had. And so this is the place to see it.
A lot of other changes have taken place at COSI.
Absolutely. I mean, that's another great thing. I mean, if you come around that region, and for our loyal customers, you know, apologize for the construction that's in the area.
It has been a little crazy.
But we are beautifying this area. I mean, you talk formally about the Souda Peninsula. I call it the People's Peninsula because you've cleaned up the water, the river, the Souda River. On the east side of COSI, that's a beautiful parkway. Mm-hmm. On the west side, we now have a 7-acre stunning park. And now they're building the Natural Vets Memorial Museum adjacent, and then some mixed use. So what used to be a kind of parking lot, kind of, you know, not necessarily more industrial area, is now a spectacular, beautified park region. And it's all about bringing people to this region. And so
the parking lot's underground.
Parking lot's a 2-story underground parking lot.
Above ground, it's a park now.
7 acres, trees, swings, benches, you know, there'll be some water activities. Just a really beautiful park.
We will continue our conversation about COSI Columbus and about the new dinosaur exhibit brought to it and by the American Museum of Natural History. If you have a question about dinosaurs, don't hesitate. Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can check out our Facebook page and post a question or a comment there. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. To All Sides, I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Steven Spielberg's 1993 film Jurassic Park used computer graphics to bring fossils to life on the screen. The dinosaurs looked impressive, but discoveries made since the film production could have changed how they were rendered. Many of those dinosaurs likely had feathers and looked more like birds than lizards. We're talking about dinosaurs this hour and the American Museum of Natural History Dinosaur Gallery opening this month at COSI. Still with us is President and CEO of COSI, Frederick Bertley. Also with us is the Division Chair and Curator for the Division of Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History, Mark Norrell. Questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Mark, you made the point earlier that we now know they probably had feathers, or they did have feathers for sure. How do we know that?
A couple of reasons. Probably the primary one, I'm sure one many of your listeners have heard about, is that we found fossils that actually preserve the feathers. Most of these come from an area in Liaoning, which is a province in northeastern China, and that they're beautiful. You can see the bones, you can actually see the feathers, and you can actually see microstructure of the feathers that are identical to those in modern birds.
When I was reading about you, it said you kind of commute to China now. It's what you do every couple of weeks or something?
Not every couple of weeks, but okay. I just came back last week, and it was the seventh time I've been there this year. So.
Is that an unfolding opportunity in China that wasn't available couple of decades?
China, since the end of the Cultural Revolution, and China's made great strides in science and in economics and everything else. I've always had a very close relationship with a number of Chinese scientists. And in fact, I've trained many PhD students in New York who've gone back to China now, positions either at some of the elite universities like Beijing University or Tsinghua or within the Academy of Sciences itself. So I have a very active research group that's sort of divided between New York and Beijing.
And you spend a lot of time in deserts.
Yeah.
Why is it that deserts are – is it because they used to be seas?
No, not so much. It's mostly that you're limited by exposure. I mean, so that if you go to – I have found fossils in the jungles in Cuba and in the jungles in Thailand. But at the same time, that it's much better if there's just no plants that would sort of obscure the ground and you can actually see things. So.
And maybe the more plants there are, the more decay there is?
Yeah, more decay. But mostly it just comes down to exposure. I mean, you're much more likely to, like around here, for instance, there are fossils that are found throughout the Midwest, but usually that they're found either due to construction projects or in the banks of rivers and where there's no vegetation covering them.
Okay. And can you see more with some of these new technologies? Are you able to look into the ground and see what's in there?
No. Okay. We wish we could. Not at this point. And probably that the biggest things are collected pretty much in the same way they've been collected for the last 150 years or so, except the one advantage we have now is we can isolate places to be able to look for fossils far better now with advanced satellite imagery, where we can see places as big as this office where there's good exposure in, and we can then go to those places and look for things.
Well, how do you know where to look?
Yeah, it's just some of it is pre-existing information. Much of the planet has been geologically mapped by people looking for mineral resources. So you have some general idea. There's also certain kinds of rocks preserve fossils better than other kinds of rocks. So you look for those sorts of rocks to be able to look for fossils. And then it's just a question of going there. And as more and more of the planet gets explored, if a place hasn't really been looked at, that there's usually a reason why it hasn't been looked at. So
I read about in The Atlantic a story, it was from August 3rd, about a dinosaur. The headline was, "A dinosaur so well preserved it looks like a statue." It was discovered in March 2011, mm-hmm. and it was a construction worker who found it or figured that there was probably something. And he had said that they're now well-trained and well-accustomed to, this was in Alberta, Canada, obviously, that they're better informed about what to look for when they come upon something that's might be a fossil.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think just the general, popular mass media, that people are aware of what fossils are now much more than they used to be.
Does something like Jurassic Park drive you crazy, or are you glad that it gets people interested in them?
I think it's kind of irrelevant. I mean, that my colleague, Neil Tyson at the American Museum, that, we talk about it. I mean, that what he does is as relevant to Star Trek as what I do is to Jurassic Park. So, it's just
astrophysicists.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. let's see. Karen and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Go ahead.
My question is the exhibit at KSI, is it going to include all the fossils in that are found in the central Ohio area? Because with all the quarries, if you go to the State House, in the rock, in the building material at the State House, you can see so many different types of fossils. And that, is that going to be type thing be included? Because I always feel that that's an untapped thing that you really can't find information about.
Yeah. What was crawling around here millions of years ago in central Ohio? Is that a piece of it, Frederick?
Not of this exhibit.
Okay.
I mean, certainly that there's no dinosaurs, for instance, that have ever been found in Ohio. I mean, the rocks are just the wrong age or the wrong type, because most of the fossils that are found throughout the Midwest are either very young, like dating back to the last ice age or so, or that they're extremely old when this area was underneath an ocean, so that the things that you see in the State House are basically, you know, mollusks like clams or other sorts of things that make up those sorts of limestones.
Okay.
But I do love that question, because it really does speak to the power of a science center and a natural history museum. So while we won't have those things on display in the dinosaur exhibit, we'll have extracurricular programming to support the importance of fossils in general and speak to what's found in the region. And so whether those are conversations or dialogues with local folks, it really speaks to the power of how these things can make you ask other questions and relate to things. So I do appreciate that question very much.
Karen, thanks a lot for that call. Anyone else out there, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page. Yeah, I think that, and this is a lot of the way CoastSides always operated, is it's the how to get to something. It's not just a thing, an artifact stuck in front of you. It's how that was discovered and how it's been analyzed and what it means and, you know, it's put in context.
Sure. And I mean, and that's really the point of a science center. We're not trying to make PhD physicists or PhD biologists. You know, that's what the hallowed halls of ivory tower and academic institutions do. But what we do really well is, one, get you excited about science, get you hooked, and through your experience, hopefully sustain that in you so you can pursue other means, whether it's reading, going online or whatever, to further move your ideas and understanding of science and science exploration.
Is it possible to know, I was reading an article about eggs, that they're now deciding that it's possible that the eggs might have had pigment in a lot of cases. And tell us about that, Mark, and what we know now about that.
Yeah. A lot of that work is being done by my extended research group, and that we're able to determine using different analytical techniques that a lot of these eggs were brilliantly colored. And that it was back in the 1860s. Charles Darwin was the first one to notice that birds were unique amongst egg-laying animals in having colored eggs. But now we've shown that, like, just like so many other characteristics, like feathers, like hollow bones, like all these different things, that those characteristics have their roots in the dinosaurs, which birds are related to, and didn't evolve just in birds. So,
and yeah. the idea I read, dinosaurs haven't gone extinct; they're just birds now.
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the big.
They've just changed over time.
Well, they didn't really even change so much. I mean, it's just like that. Our species, Homo sapiens, we're a primate. That's one group we belong to. We're also a mammal. So living birds are a kind of dinosaur, and dinosaurs are a kind of reptile. So birds are just a subgroup of reptiles. And that if we look at modern birds as a whole, they're more closely related to animals like Velociraptor and Tyrannosaurus rex than Tyrannosaurus rex is to any other dinosaur most people have ever heard of, things like Triceratops, all that kind of thing. And you can actually see a lot of the characteristics, and they're on display in this exhibit, that make that link. And one of them, for instance, is most people, I think, don't realize that Tyrannosaurus rex had a wishbone. And we have a cast of that wishbone on display in the exhibit.
Wow. That'd be a big wishbone. Thinking of them as more like birds, or as descendants of them, does that change how we think about why dinosaurs disappeared?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that in a lot of ways, you know, you can easily argue that dinosaurs are more diverse than they ever have been.
Okay.
I mean, there's at least 15,000 species of birds alive today that exist on the planet right now. There's only been about a little over 1,000 of what we call non-avian or non-bird dinosaurs that have ever been described. But if you were to look at an animal like Velociraptor, for instance, which is a very, you know, familiar dinosaur to most people because of its Jurassic Park fame, I think most people, unless they're a very trained scientist, they would just say, that's a really weird-looking bird if it was just running around today.
Right. I guess I was thinking about birds, how when there are bird kills and big bird die-offs, they're sometimes, well, they're like a canary in the coal mine. There's mm-hmm. something going wrong. And I just wondered if there might be some connection with that maybe there were you know, species of these bird dinosaurs that died off differently than the rest.
Well, I mean, it was something really bad happened to the planet about 65 million years ago, because not just the non-bird dinosaurs became extinct, but all sorts of microscopic marine animals, all kinds of plants, lots of stuff went extinct. There was one bad event that we know of, and that's when the asteroid impacted the planet off of what's now the Yucatan Peninsula in the Gulf of Mexico. But other things were going on as well. I mean, that the entire planet was becoming much, much more seasonal, because that the big oceans that occupied the middle of the continents, like here, for instance, were disappearing. Also that there was a gigantic amounts of volcanism that lasted several millions of years at the
volcanoes,
same time.
Volcanoes, yeah.
In what's now India. You know, at the time, India was floating out in the middle of the Indian Ocean as a separate continent. But at the same time, that there were all these things that came together. And I don't think you can really implicate one in particular in doing it. I mean, it's sort of like saying, you know, what caused the 1929 stock market crash, or what caused World War One, and that kind of thing. There's all these different things that are interconnected that just came together, and it pretty much wiped out the entire biota of the planet, not just dinosaurs, but everything.
So then how did birds survive?
That's a really good question. I mean, if we went to head a Mars probe, for instance, and we found all these fossils, and then we found an event like an asteroid impact, and then the planet was sterilized except for a bacteria or something, we'd have a good answer. But it's not just birds survived. I mean, there are certainly the first mammals appear at the same time the first dinosaurs appeared, about 235 million years ago. So, you know, mammals survived, obviously, or, you know, we wouldn't be here. Other things survived as well. And, you know, coming up with a reason for why some things survive is even harder than coming up with a reason for why big extinctions happen.
614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. As far as there's been a challenge to the evolutionary family tree of dinosaurs, and it's one that paleontologists have accepted for generations, but now there's three. One is way forgotten. Another one was the traditional, and there's been a change up now. What are the main characters in that tree?
Well, I think that there's a rebuttal that was published by a very eminent group of scientists last week, which shows that the signal in the change tree, while it is there, it's not as pervasive as the evidence that exists for the tree that was established at the end of the 19th century of two kinds of dinosaurs, the bird hip dinosaurs and the reptile hip dinosaurs. So I think that I don't think that that paper really changed things that much, because it's only been out for about 3 months, and it's certainly that the traditional tree has much more support in it.
How long does it take to change something up?
It depends on what it is. I mean, I think that, you know, that dinosaur paleontology, and some of the things that we show in the exhibit, isn't just about finding things and, you know, coming up with new names. A lot of it is about real science. And, you know, like when we started working on what color dinosaurs were, for instance, it's not like most people in my lab group really even cared what color they are. We just wanted to know if we were clever enough to figure it out. So
okay.
A lot of it is just driven by that. And a lot of this stuff, you know, has implications for some other things. I mean, some of the algorithms that we've written to be able to look at how species are related to one another, for instance, we're now using those same mathematical tools to work on a big project with my colleagues at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in the city to look at tumorigenesis and pancreatic cancer and ways in which that we may be able to apply these new gene editing technologies like CRISPR-9 to cause kind of extinction events before they happen in developing cancer cells. So
to cause extinction of the tumors.
Yeah.
When you're talking about all this stuff, it reminds me of something that you said about why you love paleontology, because it's a synthetic pursuit. Mm-hmm. And at first, you know, when I first read that, I thought, well, does that mean fake? But what it means, of course, is it synthesizes so many different disciplines.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very interesting. You're at one point we're talking about something that's a million years old, and at another point we're talking about changing the direction of, you know, something as horrible as pancreatic cancer.
Yeah, I mean, I think paleontology really is a great discipline for that, because is that in my lab in particular, we do a lot of neurobiology, even on living animals, and we do a lot of some molecular biology, both classical as well as some newer forms of molecular biology. We do a lot of old-fashioned paleontology as well. So it's just, it's a very creative field in that way. And you get exposed to a lot of incredibly brilliant people and work on a lot of great projects of things that you never thought you would get into.
Jeff in Baltimore, you're on the air, Baltimore, Ohio. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, how you doing this morning, Ann?
Good.
Hey, so my question is, and this is probably a little bit deeper than we were planning on getting into things this morning. From a standpoint of dating, when you're talking about from egg to adulthood, how do scientists, paleontologists, neurobiologists, how do you figure out how long it takes a dinosaur or took a dinosaur to reach adulthood? I mean, based solely off the fossil record.
Yeah, that's a good question. And that is also something that we address in a large section of the exhibit at COSI. If you take and you cut a bone, and it has to be a certain bone. It's different in humans than it is in non-avian dinosaurs. But the best one to look at in non-avian dinosaurs is the fibula, which is the little narrow bone on the bottom of your leg. And like if you take a drumstick and it's that long one that's just purely pointed, and you cut that and you look at that under a certain kind of microscope, you can actually count rings in it. And the rings represent...
Like a tree?
Exactly, that they represent annual rings. Then on the inside of the annual rings, if it's well enough preserved, you can see a lunar cycle as well, so a 28-day cycle. And there's even, you can look at it on a daily cycle as well, if it's preserved well enough. But we could pretty much always see that the yearly cycle. And as the animal is growing, that the lines are pretty evenly spaced. But then when it reaches like adult size, like somatic maturity is what we call it, that all the lines are just all packed up on top of one another. And you can see those in a microscope of a bone preparation that we did in the exhibit at COSI, and it can tell you very accurately how old the animal was. And it's not just something that we just made up from extinct animals. It was first tested on living animals, but that we knew exactly how old they were, and we could actually count them, the lines on it, and determine that that's how fast they grew, and that's how big they got. Tyrannosaurus rex, for instance, it reached adult size in just over 17 years. And the oldest tyrannosaur we know of is the Sioux specimen in Chicago, and it's 26 years old when it died.
Okay. Jeff, thanks for that question. Are we going to learn about that at COSI Columbus?
Absolutely. And I want to go back to one of the things you asked, though, Anne, was, how do scientists kind of change their understanding of things? And it's a very important question. Science, first of all, is just a process of, asking questions, collecting data, mm-hmm. and letting that guide, closer to the truth. But you think of things like cold fusion. That came out. Oh, my God, we thought we were going to solve the energy problem of the world. It took about a yearish or so, and boom, the scientists couldn't reproduce that, and fine, it went away. Mm-hmm. But you look at something like measles and a link to vaccination with autism. Here's something that fraudulently came out in 1988 by Andrew Wakefield, a British scientist, a medical doctor came up with this supposed link. It was disproved later. He had to retract the paper, et cetera, et cetera. He fell from grace, blah, blah, blah. In 2017, there are still people who actually link measles vaccines to causing autism. And so you have parents in this country who are electing not to vaccinate their kids. Highly educated. And some kids die in the United States of America every year because of measles. So it's a great question, the combination of A, when does science redirect based on information, but two, the bigger audience, the world audience, how do they change their ideas and opinions and make important decisions about how they're going to live their lives?
We're going to continue our conversation. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. My guest, you just heard from Frederick Bertley. He's president and CEO of COSI Columbus, which has a new exhibit, dinosaur exhibit opening on November 18th. Also with us is Mark Norrell. He's the division chair and curator for the Division of Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History, which is behind this new dinosaur exhibit, and will be opening up a permanent exhibit there as well. Well, next March. Stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about dinosaurs this hour in the American Museum of Natural History Dinosaur Gallery opening this month at COSI Columbus. Still with us is President and CEO of COSI, Frederick Bertley, and also with us is the Division Chair and Curator for the Division of Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History, Mark Norrell. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And let's just turn right to an email from a listener who asks, did dinosaurs sleep? And if so, how did a T-Rex sleep? And I'm just going to say, yeah, they had to sleep.
Sure.
It's
yeah.
a biological
everything,
necessity.
Everything has to sleep. Certainly some big herbivorous animals today, plant-eating animals, don't sleep very much. Like elephants, they feed around 20 hours a day just to keep their metabolism going, but they do sleep. And that if you not of Tyrannosaurus rex, but of several dinosaurs, we actually have information that the bipedal ones, at least, you know, just squatted down on the ground like birds did, because we can see those imprints.
Okay.
And we've also, you know, we've excavated, my group has excavated dinosaurs sitting on top of their nests in the same position that modern birds do in Mongolia over the last couple of decades, so that we know
just sitting there on top of some eggs.
Yeah, just like a hen would today on top of its eggs.
That's incredible. And so the follow-up question, Mark, is did they snore? And was there an annoying dinosaur in the crew that was like, oh, sure he goes, Mr. T-Rex snoring down the house.
Yeah.
Oh, my God. Did they twitch when they dream? Philip in Licking County, you're on the air. Hi, Philip.
Yes, good morning, Ms. Fisher, and to Mr. President and your other guests. Thanks very much for taking the call.
Sure.
Very great that you're going to have this particular exhibit and that I'm planning to come and participate. My question is just this. It's that COSI is going to have this very detailed and scientifically accurate exhibit, but a museum, which shall remain nameless at this point, that's to the south of here in Ohio, their estimation is that humans actually rode on dinosaurs, and, well, that's a particular viewpoint. How are we ever going to get to the point of reconciling that what you're exhibiting is actually closer and actually is the truth, and to the other version of what is being exhibited from their viewpoint. So if that's one of the things that we can get discussed, and once and for all, just get it. So thank you. I'll hang up, and then much success to your exhibit.
Thanks, Philip.
Okay. I think that, like, when you look at this question, that what that other nameless museum is showing, they are showing the truth, but the truth is a relativistic thing. The truth is very different to very different people. The more that you travel around the world, you can see it. Whereas that's a belief system. What we're trying to show is what we know, not what we believe. And those are two very, very different things. I mean, that scientists all the time, there's all kinds of problems. I'll say that, well, we don't know. And I don't think we'll ever know, because I can't see a data set that would ever support it. To people who believe, they can always have a belief that explains everything. So it's two very different ways of looking at the world.
It's not science, though.
It's not science by any means.
Okay.
As a scientist, you have to be able to say every morning when you walk into your laboratory, there might be a paper on your computer screen that somebody's just published that's shown everything you've ever done in your life is wrong. And you got to start over. And that doesn't work in belief systems.
No, I mean, absolutely. And the other piece to that is you always have to look for people's motives behind certain things. And the neat part about science is, again, it's a process. And the motivation behind science is just to collect, to ask smart questions and collect as much information as you can to help guide your opinions on what you're digging into. And when you look at mixing, you know, humans and dinosaurs at the same time, I mean, what's behind that? What's driving that presentation of, as Dr. Norrell said, of their version of the truth? And so that's where I'll leave it.
Hmm. Okay, Philip, thanks for that call. Harry in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Harry.
Hi. You mentioned earlier that in this region, aquatic fossils are found, but not actual dinosaur fossils. Where was this region located when those aquatic fossils were deposited? Where in the world were they located?
Yeah, North America has pretty much been in a stable latitudinal position for a very long time. There's been some north-south drift. You can't really say where it was in the world because at the time when most of the animals that lived here were preserved, there was a supercontinent that was called Pangaea. So it was before the continents broke up, first into Laurasia, the northern continent, and Gondwana, the southern continent, and then those further fragmented into the continents that we have today. So positioning, you know, Pangaea on the globe, you can't really talk about it relative to any other continent because there was only one continent. But it was, nevertheless, is that North America was slightly, maybe 10 to 15 degrees more southerly in latitude than it is now.
Okay, Harry, thanks. When you were talking about the rings and the bones to show daily, yearly, and the lunar, was that?
Yeah.
That just really kills me. Is that part of molecular paleontology, or that's not? That molecular is something different?
Molecular paleontology is something different, and it's a kind of a hot field right now. I mean, one of the top people in it is a woman named Yasmina Wyman, and is a student at Yale, which I'm one of her dissertation supervisors, and she's really taking it to the next level of looking at biomolecules that have been preserved for hundreds of millions of years in some cases, of looking at the egg coloring things that we mentioned before.
Okay.
Of, you know, actually teasing some of those things that we, even 10 years ago, I couldn't imagine we'd have instrumentation to be able to do some of this stuff.
You said it's a hot field. What does that mean? I mean, when you talk, is it something people want to fund? Is that what you mean by that?
Yeah, it's very fundable. It is kind of what the bone stuff is called, paleohistology, because basically it's doing histology the way they would do on a living animal, but doing it on animals that are tens of millions of years old. That was like a big growth area maybe 20 years ago is when those papers first started appearing. So lots of people were doing it, made a lot of, you know, really great new discoveries. Now that the molecular paleontology aspect of it is like that, it's something new. And so that's a big up-and-coming area. Another big up-and-coming area is paleoneurology, so where we're looking at dinosaur brains. And actually, we cover quite a bit of that in the exhibit at COSAI as well, because a lot of that emanated in either my group or in groups that we're affiliated with.
They had small brains.
Not really.
Okay.
I mean, it depends, because the ones that are most closely related to birds had a very bird-like brain, big. And originally, I made this observation years and years and years ago, that I thought that the large brains that the birds have, a really big neocortex, for instance, a visual processing center, had to do with navigating a three-dimensional world. So it evolved at the same time flight evolved. But then over the last 6 or 7 years, we've shown that's totally incorrect, is that in fact that the big brain developed before flight developed, because we can, using CAT scan radiation, we can reconstruct what the brain looked like of a Tyrannosaur, a Velociraptor, or of any of these things. And then mathematically, we can describe those brains and make empirical comparisons with the brains of modern birds. So then the next step we did was then, well, what do they use that part of the brain for? So we built these little PET scan helmets that fit on birds, flew them in a wind tunnel, and we found out that the big part of the brain, the neocortex, they don't use very much of it when they're flying. That it's because it's really metabolically expensive. They can shut it down, and that explains why birds can fly when they're sleeping, for instance. And you know, but they do use it when they land, and landing is a hard problem. I mean, if you talk to people who design airplanes, for instance, trying to land an advanced fighter jet on an aircraft carrier in a pitching sea is computationally incredibly hard. But birds are able to land on, you know, telephone wires that are swinging in the wind. So
right.
As soon as they start to land, the whole visual center of their brain just lights up and is burning tons of calories, because they're using their eyes and the visual information to process to coordinate the all the rest of their body to be able to land.
That's incredible. I just got to say that's incredible.
And then how it's using that frontal cortex is metabolically
expensive,
taxing, which is why they don't use it when they're flying, because they use all the other calories to fly.
Yeah, it's very energy intensive to fly, so that they try to just cut back as much as they can. But when they land, a little bit when they take off, but mostly when they land.
I read this passage from Live Science, and it said, you know, once this question, whatever it was, is settled, it can help researchers understand how dinosaurs diversified, evolved, and took over the world so quickly. And I wondered if you could help what does that mean, took over the world so quickly? Do you know what they're talking about?
Yeah,
was it particularly fast-paced?
I kind of know, and I disagree. But
okay, all right.
It's just because, you know, dinosaurs were sort of the dominant terrestrial group of animals for a very, very long time. But, you know, they first appear about 235, 237 million years ago. And that from then until 65 million years ago, that they were the you know, dominant kind of group. But I don't think they diversified necessarily really quickly. I mean, mammals, after the demise of the traditional dinosaurs and stuff, that they diversified equally as quickly. So, to say that one group is the dominant group on the planet also can just be an issue of semantics of how you define that group. So.
Okay. One more quick call. Hi, Michael in Columbus. You're on the air.
Hi. I was actually wondering, because you were talking about neuropaleontology, and I know there's a lot of very smart modern birds like corvids and parrots, and I was wondering if through that or through your, if you know if there's any bird-like dinosaurs that exhibit that level of intelligence or, you know, use tools like, you know, modern corvids like crows and ravens, et cetera.
Yeah, we don't really have any evidence of, you know, tool using like that ravens and crows use. But I think that is sort of the reason of most of us are thinking that the really large neocortex that developed. I mean, these animals became increasingly sophisticated in hunting, in using their visual senses. The only evidence that we really have of a behavior that you would call advanced are the few times that we can see behaviors in fossils. And some of that is the nesting animals that we found, where that they are sitting on top of their eggs, brooding their nests in the same way modern birds do, but also from trackways. And we
from
trackways, from footprints.
Okay.
That in one of the footprint displays that we have in the COSI exhibit, that there's what looks like just a big jumble of footprints of large sauropod dinosaurs, the big, you know, traditional ones. And that if you kind of dissect that out, you can show that the herd was structured in the same way that elephant herds are structured today, where all the big ones are out in front and on the sides, and all the juveniles are walking in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, a sign of at least an advanced social behavior. There's also signs of theropod dinosaurs, or the carnivorous dinosaurs, of trackways of them, fossil trackways, which show that they hunted in packs. Some of them. So again, that's considered to be an advanced social behavior and a higher level of intelligence than something like a lizard or a crocodile would have.
Michael, thanks for that call. One quick question, Frederick Bertley. You had talked to me last year about trying to bring a festival, like a COSI festival, to Columbus.
Absolutely.
Any progress on that front?
Absolutely. We're working on that as we speak. I mean, we want to launch this fantastic partnership with AMNH,
right?
November 18th and then through into March. But we're looking to have our first science festival, hopefully, in 2018. And that really speaks to, again, the reach of COSI. We have some fantastic things at the mothership, including this great exhibit we're about to open. But we also want to penetrate where people live, learn, and lounge. We want to be out in communities and neighborhoods. And one real great way of doing that is having a festival. So where people are in schools, in churches, in synagogues, wherever they hang out, community centers, bars, restaurants, bring science there and get them to feel excited. And hopefully they'll come and check out, you know, Mark's great exhibit at COSI.
Frederick Bertley, thank you so much for joining us today.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And thanks for having me on.
Frederick Bertley is president and CEO of COSI Columbus. And Mark Norrell, thanks to you as well. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Mark Norrell is a division chair and curator for the Division of Paleontology at the American Museum of Natural History. The American Museum of Natural History Dinosaur Gallery is set to open November 18 at COSI Columbus. You can go to the link on our website to check out more about that. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.